Well, welcome to another edition of the Health First Show. We're talking boxing. We're talking head injuries today. We're going to be talking with Dr. Goodman and about her work with head injuries. We're going to be talking with her in the first half of the show. In the second half of the show, we're going to be talking about mindfulness and mindful meditation made simple. But before we do that, here's Reg with the health news.
Women who were exposed to tobacco smoke in the womb may be at increased risk for diabetes, a new study suggests. Researchers looked at about 1,800 women with diabetes, age 44 to 54 in California. They found a strong link between their diabetes and parental smoking during pregnancy. The researchers say smoking by mothers was associated with a stronger risk of diabetes than smoking by fathers. The link between parents smoking and higher diabetes risk remained even after researchers compensated for factors such as race or a woman's birth weight or current body mass index. The study was presented at the Endocrine Society's annual meeting in San Diego. Data and conclusions presented at meetings are usually considered preliminary until published in a peer-reviewed medical journal. While the study doesn't establish a direct cause and effect relationship between smoking and pregnancy and a daughter's diabetes, researchers say it adds to evidence that prenatal environmental chemical exposures might contribute to adult diabetes. A new study finds a vegetarian diet might cut your risk of colorectal cancer by 20%. Researchers say for fish-eating vegetarians, the protective link is even stronger. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in the United States, and the study's lead researcher says screening efforts, including colonoscopy, have helped save many lives by detecting precancerous polyps. The new study, which involved more than 77,000 adults, found people consuming healthy vegetarian diets may have a lower risk of colon and rectal cancers than non-vegetarians. The research, published in the March 9th online edition of JAMA Internal Medicine, included data on nearly 78,000 men and women enrolled in the Adventist Health Study 2. After 7 years of follow-up, 380 cases of colon cancer and 110 cases of rectal cancer were identified. Eating a modest amount of nuts appears to lower the risk for teens of developing conditions that raise the chances of heart disease later in life, new research suggests. By modest, investigators mean eating at least 3 small handfuls of nuts a week. In the study, nut-eating teens had less than half the risk for developing metabolic syndrome as those who did not eat nuts. Metabolic syndrome is a cluster of symptoms that heighten the risk of early heart disease and type 2 diabetes. The study authors say the bad news is roughly 75% of U.S. teens eat no nuts. The study's findings were presented at the Endocrine Society's annual meeting in San Diego. Research presented at meetings should be viewed as preliminary until published in a peer-reviewed medical journal. And finally, new research suggests people who are fit in their 40s seem to retain more brain volume 2 decades later and also perform better on decision-making tests. The analysis of more than 1,200 participants who were tracked for more than 20 years showed those with lower fitness levels at midlife had smaller brain volumes in their 60s, a sign of accelerated brain aging. The research results were presented at the March 4th meeting in Baltimore of the American Heart Association. Studies presented at scientific conferences typically have not been published or peer-reviewed, and results are considered preliminary. For the study, just under 1,300 people underwent exercise treadmill testing in the 1970s when their average age was 41. In their 60s, the participants underwent MRI brain scans and mental performance tests.
Hey, thanks for that, Rich. Makes me want to keep exercising through my middle ages here. Our first guest, Dr. Margaret Goldman, knows all about exercising. She's a Las Vegas neurologist and is a founder of the Voluntary Anti-Doping Association. It's a non-for-profit organization that creates and promotes anti-doping practices. She's written a book that is called The Ring. No, sorry, it's Death in Vegas. Dr. Goodman, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Tell us a little bit about, it's not often that we talk to a woman that's involved in boxing. Tell us a little bit about how you got interested in the sport yourself.
Well, in about 1993, I started performing consultations on fighters. I was obviously living in Las Vegas, and there were some instances where the commission here was determining whether or not a fighter should be eligible to compete. So I was able to perform exams on people like George Foreman, Tommy Hitman Hearns, Meldrick Taylor, and I thought it would be wonderful to become a ring doctor, the doctors that actually work the fights, and so I worked in the amateurs for about a year and a half, and then studied the sport as much as I could, and when a spot opened up, I was honored by being placed on the Athletic Commission as a ring physician. And during that tenure from about 94 to 2005, I worked about 500 fight cards, also became their chief ringside physician, and also actually worked as head of the medical advisory board here in the state of Nevada. And during that time, we would assess fighters, not just boxers, but mixed martial arts fighters, those that compete in things like UFC, to determine their eligibility to compete and what kind of medical tests. And I've just always been fascinated by both sports and always loved the fighters themselves.
Now, you've written a novel about your experience. Well, I guess that relates to what you know about the fighting. Why did you do a novel as opposed to maybe an expose or a documentary?
You know, when I left the Athletic Commission as a ring physician in 2005, I was pretty perturbed, concerned, that I didn't believe that the fighters were protected thoroughly enough. There were things that were falling through the cracks. We had had some serious injuries. And at that time, I was actually contacted after an article that appeared in the New York Times to do a tell-all, to do a nonfiction story of issues that I felt were important, but things that I had faced. And, you know, to be honest with you, no one really wants to read a book from someone about boxing unless they're, you know, Oscar De La Hoya or Muhammad Ali, someone of that stature. And the other thing was, I still lived and worked in the state of Nevada, and to talk about all these issues from a nonfiction standpoint really would have been too difficult. I could have ended up at the bottom of Lake Mead, and so I thought that there was just too much politics involved and that it wasn't the right thing. So I still had all of these issues that I thought were so important for the fighters, and to be honest, it was a very cathartic experience to write about those, even under the framework of a novel.
Well, so, Dr. Goodman, let's talk about whether it's mixed martial arts or boxing or, you know, some of these martial arts, even where there is contact to the head. What are the long-term effects of these blows to the head that you've seen?
You know, I've seen anything where fighters have suffered concussions. In my office practice, I've seen soccer players, basketball players with concussions. I think that we're just beginning to find out the long-term risks. You know, what we face are acute injuries as well, but the chronic injuries that are coming up from some of the research being done in chronic traumatic encephalopathy are just profound. I think on some of the autopsies that Boston University has done in this area, I mean, there's been individuals as young as age 17 that they've seen stuff beginning to show signs and symptoms in their brain of a dementia. And so, you know, they were obviously, these individuals had died from other things other than contact sports, but in just looking at their brains on autopsy, without being heavily involved in any kind of contact sport endeavor, they're seeing changes. So I don't think we really even know the vastness of this. Just when people are allowing their children to participate in football in either junior high school, or even on the college level, that we're starting to see these changes. So it's pretty frightening in a lot of respects. I'm certainly not someone that would come out and say we need to disallow contact sports of any kind, but it's not just on a professional level or even on an amateur level where we're starting to see mixed martial arts spring up in the schools. There's obviously amateur programs in boxing, but we're also seeing it in things not just like hockey or football, but also in soccer. So I think it's something that parents need to be aware of. I have a good friend who works with Boston University doing some of the research on chronic traumatic encephalopathy that's been talked about in football. And he wrote a book, I think it was last year, on why parents shouldn't really allow their children to participate in contact sports below the age of 14. So I think we're seeing this extrapolated to the professional side, but I can tell you it is very worrisome.
Well, Dr. Goodman, you know, you must have been in you said that if you did an expose, you would be in a precarious position. But what would happen if, you know, George Foreman comes to you, you know, for a pre-fight examination and you say, no, that's not going to happen. That fight's not going to happen. How much pressure was there?
There was a tremendous amount of pressure. I remember my significant other, who I use as an example, obviously it's fictional as far as most of the story, but I use him as an example in the novel for the male character, the emergency room physician. But my significant other was the main physician for the Athletic Commission for almost 25 years. He also worked as a commissioner. And I remember when I went to him, I had just met him, and I said, I want to train to be a ring physician, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. And his first statement to me was, can you handle the pressure? And I'm kind of like, well, how could there be so much pressure? You're just being a doctor, right? Well, there is a tremendous amount of pressure, especially when there's millions of dollars being wagered on these fights. And also there's millions of dollars based on whether or not a fight takes place. And so, determining someone's fitness to fight or ability to compete, obviously, I think George Foreman's way too smart to think about ever resuming his career again. I can't think exactly how old he must be, but I think he must be close to 60 at this point, if not more. I'm not sure. But it's hard to pin an actual age requirement on whether or not someone should compete. There's so many laws against that, as far as, Disability Act saying that someone based on age shouldn't be allowed to compete. But obviously, as you get older, there's more risk factors. But to answer your question, yes, there's a tremendous amount of pressure, not just in deciding whether or not someone deserves a license or is fit to compete, but also when you're working ringside. In the state of Nevada, and it's different from state-to-state jurisdiction, the doctor isn't the one that actually determines if a fight should stop. The way it works here, and it continues to work here, is the doctor makes a recommendation to the referee that the fight should stop. So it's essentially the same. I can't think any referee would really overrule the physician. But I can tell you there was a huge amount of pressure related to that. There's also a huge amount of pressure on you just even examining a fighter after a fight. There's a story in the news today about a young man, I think he was 23 years of age, that died in Australia, who had a pretty good record of knockouts of other individuals, and he was in a tough fight and I think collapsed a few hours after the fight. And so, you sit there and you want to do everything for the good of the athlete, but it's hard to know that when you send them home that night, if they look good, that, they're really okay. And you can't scan everybody after a fight with a CAT scan, mm-hmm. So you have to make those judgments, and it does weigh on you pretty heavily.
Oh, and I imagine the boxer saying, oh, I'm fine. I just want to get out of here, right?
Exactly. Yeah. They always say that. They're like the worst judge of themselves, whether or not they're okay or not. And so that's why it helps to have examined as many fighters as possible. I mean, I obviously examined several thousand fighters. And it helps in my capacity as a neurologist, because I would, it's kind of twofold. One, it helped me as a neurologist to work as a ring physician, because it was the only time a neurologist would ever be able to see a concussion as it was happening. Mm-hmm. But on the other side of the coin, as a neurologist, I was able to use my background, which would help me in assessing fighters as to which fighters would be more, at risk during a fight. And that's why we have pre-fight medical tests. I was very proud of the fact that which would seem like a no-brainer, I had to use the pun intended, but that we require fighters to have undergone an MRI before they would fight in the state of Nevada, and that's extremely helpful, because you want to know what their brain looks like as much as you can and how they are from a neurological standpoint before they step in the ring.
Fascinating. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking more with Dr. Margaret Goodman about her book, Death in Vegas.